Welcome to episode 9 of the Infectious Myth. This is our first joint episode of the podcast, How Positive Are You?, that I co-host with Elizabeth Ely from New York City. She's also on the show today. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, David. I'm glad to be here and glad to be interviewing someone on a very historic topic on the 30th anniversary. So please go on.
Yes. Today we're taping a day before what many of us call AIDS Fraud Day, the anniversary of the press conference in 1984, where Robert Gallo, shortly after having filed patents, but before having published any science, announced at this a U.S. government-sponsored press conference that he had found the cause of AIDS, which he called HTLV-3, which is now known as HIV. April 23, 2014 is the 30th anniversary of this date. Gallo's science soon started to unravel in a variety of different frauds became public, and we'll touch on some of those issues today. But anyway, what Gallo was claiming was that he had found an antibody test for this new virus, the one that he had just invented. On this basis, millions of people around the world have been told that they're going to die a quick and painful death, and many of them have been poisoned with some of the most toxic drugs ever given to humans. Our guest today is Rodney Richards, who is one of the founding scientists of Amgen, and it was back in 1984 that they began a joint venture with Abbott to develop new testing technologies. So there's really nobody better to talk about HIV tests from a critical perspective. And apart from tomorrow being the 30th anniversary of the AIDS fraud, very recently, I believe April 11th, the CDC radically changed the definition of, quote, HIV infection, despite the fact that HIV has never been purified. And now we have things like a doctor's note plus one symptom of AIDS being equivalent to a definition or a diagnosis of HIV infection. We had Rodney Richards.
Seriously? Seriously, David? Like, not even a positive HIV test at all?
No,
any
no.
Kind?
No, we will get into that. Yes, if I'm reading it correctly, a doctor's note plus another lab test like a CD4 immune cell count or a minor infection such as a fungal infection or a bacterial infection can be used to diagnose HIV infection.
Amazing.
Rodney was with us on episode 6 of the podcast, How Positive Are You?, quite some time ago. But today, Rodney is back again to help us understand these so-called HIV testing technologies, their strengths and weaknesses, and how this fits into the history of HIV and AIDS, starting with April 23rd, 1984, and continuing to the CDC definitional changes of a few days ago. Welcome to the show, Rodney.
Well, thank you, David, and hello, Elizabeth.
Hi.
I appreciate you inviting me to participate.
Yes. So... what Robert Gallo invented so many years ago was the ELISA test, or he invented an HIV form of the ELISA test, because the ELISA technology predated the era of AIDS, correct?
Yes, it's called an antibody test, and I was thrown a little bit. He didn't publish until May in the journal Science, the technologies. And I was thinking, how can this be the 30th anniversary? And then you reminded me that they announced the probable cause of AIDS had been found before it was published and reviewed by fellow scientists. So
yeah,
that explains it.
Yes,
I wanted to also acknowledge that today is Earth Day. I don't think there's any relationship between the two, but... I started working with Abbott Laboratories shortly after they had licensed the technology from Robert Gallo. I did not develop the test directly, but I was involved in the research and the development from time zero. As Abbott pointed out, that when they launched their tests for FDA approval, they said that there is no established standard for establishing the presence or absence of HIV antibody in a blood sample. So they never made a claim that their test could be used to diagnose infection with HIV.
And it tells us that you don't find virus, right? That's the key fact that a lot of people find astonishing. Like, well, why are they called HIV tests if they don't find HIV?
Right. Well, actually, you know, none of the tests on the market that are currently used to diagnose infection with HIV claim diagnose infection with HIV. It's just an established standard of practice based on recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control, or the CDC. And now I would like to emphasize that the CDC is not required by law to base its recommendations on reproducible scientific evidence. They are a public health agency. The FDA, on the other hand, is bound by law to base approval of products on reproducible scientific evidence. And that's the manufacturers of the so-called HIV test have to go through the FDA, and that is why the manufacturers make no claim that their products can be used to diagnose infection with HIV with any degree of stated certainty.
So, I mean, that's been a problem for the HIV test for the entire duration, is that people have admitted quite openly that the ELISA test, which is a relatively simple kind of antibody test, they've admitted that that's not accurate. So they say, well, you have to confirm that with the Western blot test, but that's another antibody test, and that's also not validated against any unambiguous standards, such as purification of HIV. And now they appear to be dumping the Western blot test in favor of others. But before we get our listeners totally bogged down, can you explain the difference between the ELISA and Western blot antibody tests in relatively simple terms?
Yes, I can. And before that, I had a comment. In 1986, researchers from the CDC published an article in the Journal of American Medical Association where they note that, quote, evaluation of a new test requires an established or known standard for comparison. At this point, however, no established standard exists for identifying HIV infection in asymptomatic people. And they went on that paper and said, because there is no standard for evaluation of a test for diagnosing infection, they defined specimens that were positive on both ELISA and Western blot as infected. So it was a definition, or a proclamation, if you will, that people who were positive on these two tests should be considered infected.
Right. So just avoid going in an endless loop of testing where you do the ELISA test and you say, well, you know, that's not a gold standard, so we'll do the Western blot. But that's not a gold standard,
yes.
So we'll come up with a new test. So to stop it, you just say, well, if you're positive on both, then you're infected.
Right. That is a declaration from the CDC. That's not language that you'll find in a package insert that's been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And I should pause for a second here. There is one test approved by the FDA. It's in that is approved for confirming infection with HIV. However, if you read in the package insert, the significance of that confirmation is simply that the person with that combination of test results should be considered HIV infected. So again, it's the word is there, but the actual certainty is not. There is no certainty. And the Western blot was an additional, more specific assay that was developed really more so you could tell blood donors who tested positive on ELISA that they're either not infected or that they're indeterminate. It was not really designed to confirm infection in HIV, and indeed it doesn't even use that language. It's a supplemental test, according to the FDA.
And you mentioned that in detail in your interview with How Positive Are You in 2008, I believe. Very interesting history, that there was a 1985 decision made by the CDC to let people know if they tested positive, if their blood tested positive at a blood bank. And so a lot
That's
of healthy
correct.
People,
yeah,
a lot of healthy people were being told, you know, you might have HIV infection, get yourself to a doctor. And that's why, possibly why, the Western blot was developed, to tell these
Well,
there were
tens of thousands of blood donors that were likely told that they may be infected with HIV based on the ELISA antibody screening test. And there was no, they were simply told to go to your physician and work it out. But the physicians had no tools to say one way or the other, are you infected or are you not infected? I don't know. They ask about the risk factors. And I can imagine it must have been quite terrifying for thousands of persons in the United States when it was first launched. I don't want to throw too much science in here, but the ELISA simply looks to see if a person has antibodies, okay, to any part of the virus. Western blot actually separates the building blocks of the virus, if you will, based on size on a strip. Mm-hmm. And that way you can answer the question, which antibodies do you have to HIV, not just if you have any antibodies to HIV. And then based on certain combinations of antibodies, the research scientists tried to distinguish between healthy people and persons with clinical AIDS. The problem is that about 19-20% of the population of the United States has antibodies to one or more of those proteins on that strip. So that's why they had to come up with what's called an evaluation criteria. If you have antibodies to this protein and that protein, then you should be told that you're infected. If you don't have the requisite number of antibodies, then you're told you're indeterminate. And then people were told, well, if you're indeterminate for 6 months or longer, then you're almost certainly not infected. Okay, although those people still are not allowed to go back to blood banks and donate.
So, and also around the world, there were something like at least 10 different interpretations of the Western blot have been determined, so that depending on which organization or which country analyzed your strip, they could reach different conclusions.
Yes, you could be positive in one country, you would not be negative in another country, but you could be persistently indeterminate in another country and therefore almost certainly not infected. Well, in the first country, you're definitely infected. So that caused quite some confusion.
So basically, I mean, I never understood the Western blot, because if the proteins in the Western blot came from the virus, you should have antibodies to all of them. And if you're not infected, you should have antibodies to none of them. I mean, if the proteins are truly specific to HIV, a Western blot should either light up every protein or light up none of them, and there should be nothing in between, because anything in between indicates some kind of serious error. But in reality,
well, yeah,
there are a few people who light up everything, and a lot of people who light up just a couple.
That's correct, and I'm sure you're well familiar with the concept of false positive reactions, meaning that many people have antibodies on every test, not just HIV. They have, coincidentally, antibodies that bind to the germ proteins. Now, in the case of HIV, as Elizabeth mentioned earlier, it's never really been purified and put directly into a bottle so that the proteins of the virus can be directly characterized. The proteins on the Western blot that are referred to as HIV proteins are defined by the fact that people with clinical AIDS had antibodies that reacted to those proteins. So,
but how did they define somebody? I mean, okay, this bends my mind, because AIDS could be tuberculosis, for example, and so how would I be able to say, okay, this person prior to an HIV test, because we're back in pre-84, so Gallo's developing this test. So we have somebody with tuberculosis and says, okay, I think you have AIDS, and I think you don't have AIDS. Like, how would he have determined whether somebody with an illness, since there's none unique to AIDS, would have had AIDS prior to an HIV test existing?
Well, you don't know. We don't know how many Western blot declarations are false positives.
Yeah.
Blood banks estimate that 10% of the population that donates blood and who are told that they're HIV positive are very likely false positives. But that's the cost of ensuring a blood supply that is free from any possible HIV.
And they will discard the blood in that case, and so even if it's a false positive, they don't really care as long as you don't discard too much blood, because
right.
not much harm has been done, and they've avoided, you know, if they figure that most of the blood that's reacts on the test is harmful, then they've avoided giving any harmful blood at the expense of throwing out some blood that's not harmful.
That's correct. I believe currently, based on the sensitivity of the ELISA, HIV ELISA test, about 1 in 600 units of blood are discarded, which is really not hurting the business that much.
Yeah.
The damage comes to the persons with the positive ELISA test. And as I said, the Western blot allowed the vast majority of those persons who had positive ELISAs, the thousands that I was talking of, or tens of thousands, to be told that they were very likely not infected with HIV. On the other hand, what's interesting, David, is with the old definition or evaluation criteria from the Food and Drug Administration for the Western blot, only about half of people with confirmed clinical AIDS scored positive on Western blot. So they couldn't even confirm, and still today, many people with clinical AIDS, risk factors consistent with viral infection, are indeterminate on Western blot.
Well, in Gallo's original research, only about half of the people who were considered to have AIDS had a positive culture, which is considered a better test than ELISA. And yet they just ignored that and said, because 90% of these people we diagnosed with, were defined as having AIDS, were positive with antibodies, we'll go with the 90%, and we'll assume that all of those, or at least 90% of those people, have AIDS.
You're right. In fact, it was only 36% of people with clinical AIDS in Gallo's original publications could be proven to be infected with HIV based on the accepted standards of culture.
Right, which his standards for culture were pretty low. It was like if we put their blood into a culture and when we get particles that look like a virus, if we get signs of a certain enzyme called reverse transcriptase, if we get a couple other things like the detection of a protein called P24, we'll say that there's a virus in there, but we can't actually prove it. So even
that's correct.
Culturing is not a very accurate.
No, it's not. It's not a tool that can be used because it comes up negative in many persons that are perceived to have AIDS, and we don't routinely culture people with negative ELISA and Western blots, so we don't know the rate of false positives on culture. But there are studies in the literature of persons that are culture positive. Yet antibody negative.
Right. I think just about every combination of that. And you would think that they would say, okay, well, since there's such a difference between culture and antibody, we'll go with culture. But culture is more expensive, takes longer, and diagnoses less people. So they
right.
get at least double the number of people if they go with antibody tests. Which is,
yes.
okay, if you don't mind the life of the people that you're diagnosing with a fatal illness.
Yes.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this new document from the CDC, which, if I'm correct, was April the 11th. Yeah, it was April the 11th, and that's a pronouncement. As you pointed out, the CDC doesn't have to base their pronouncements on science, and they have revised the criteria for a confirmed case of HIV, which I guess is saying this is what HIV infection is. Now, the first one is maybe less controversial than the second. It's for cases of HIV infection that are diagnosed with laboratory evidence. And they have they've changed the algorithm, but it's still a multi-test algorithm. So it says a
yes.
positive result from an initial HIV antibody or combination antigen-antibody test and an accompanying or subsequent positive result from a supplemental HIV test different from the initial test. So this is a little
right.
bit different than the past, right?
It was considerably. But I'd like to also emphasize that in this document they talk about the scope and applicability of the new definitions, and this is for surveillance, okay? I mean, technically they're not saying that doctors should use these techniques. It's only for surveillance. But curiously, and the way they word it is, this revised case definition is intended primarily for public health surveillance of HIV infection on the population level. But it's curious because we don't really do surveillance, in other words, mass testing of the general public in the United States. And I mean, there is one, it's called the National Health and Nutrition Exam Survey. That's a population-based survey in the United States. About 7,000 people a year participate in this survey, which represents about 1 out of 50,000 of our citizens. So it's not really extensive. And HIV is included in there, as well as herpes and chlamydia and gonorrhea and many other tests. So, you know, I suppose these new recommendations technically could be used in that population survey, but they should not be used in the medical office. But my feeling is that they will start using these in the medical office, and it will become the standard of care.
Right. I mean, some of the things they say here are very worrisome. It says, for surveillance purposes, supplemental tests can include some not approved by the FDA for diagnosis.
Yeah, that's correct.
Viral load test, HIV2 Western blot, and NAT, which is another kind of viral load test, right?
Yeah. And, yeah, it's curious because these screening tests were designed to be very sensitive, meaning that they're going to err. They're designed to be oversensitive so that you capture every single last possible infectious unit from the blood supply. There's going to be a lot of false positives. In fact, the majority of positives are going to be false positives.
Right.
And now they're saying that you can use these screening tests, two of them, to confirm the infection, which is, I think, going to be very problematic. I mean, the situation is already problematic, but to two ELISAs now can be used as long as they're based on different principles. Now, but they also emphasize that because the building blocks that are used to build these tests are the protein building blocks of HIV are proprietary. You don't know if you're using a test. They call it orthogonal, if the tests are orthogonal.
Well, and I was gonna mention that because in mathematics, orthogonal means two lines that are at right angles to each other and therefore have nothing in common, so that if you follow one track and you say you're going east and you follow another track which is orthogonal going north, you're making no progress to the east when you go north and no progress to the north when you go east. But in this case, they're allowing tests that are almost identical to be considered orthogonal.
Yes, and this is, you know, very concerning. Even in the developing world, where multiple ELISA test algorithms are used to diagnose infection with HIV, they are with certainty orthogonal. In other words, HIV is believed to be made of like 10 to 12 major proteins. If one test uses three of those proteins and another test uses a different three of those proteins, the idea is the chances that you're going to have a false positive on both of those due to cross-reacting antibodies is minimized. Okay, now, here in the United States, they're recommending that you don't have to do that anymore.
Which is bizarre. And, I mean, is this intended to get more people diagnosed as HIV positive because they're running out of patients or what?
I have no idea what the story is. What the politics or possible public health benefits or individual health benefits could come out of this revised case definition.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of this is based on the assumption that you know, there are things like false positive reactions to a specific protein, but if there are people who have a hyperactive immune system that tend to react, you know, more vigorously to any antigen, then they're likely to get more of a reaction on a whole variety of proteins, and therefore much more likely to test HIV positive because of some condition in their body.
That is correct. And it's very unusual. I mean, one of the biggest problems with HIV is that it is the only germ that is diagnosed in the complete absence of any symptoms or even risks consistent with infection. It'd be like taking your child to the doctors for a sprained ankle, and they would do a strep test on him. They don't do that. They don't do a strep test unless there are symptoms there, and then the test is ordered to confirm a clinical suspicion. In HIV, the vast majority of people are completely without any symptoms and in many cases without any risk for infection. Every antibody test is subject to these false positive problems, and that's why none of them are ever used in the absence of symptoms to diagnose the presence or absence of a germ.
Right. And in many cases, people can be diagnosed with AIDS in the United States without any symptoms because they run a second test called a CD4 immune cell test, and if that produces a count that's under, I think, 200, then you're considered to have AIDS without any symptoms of AIDS.
Yes, you're correct.
Yes.
And again, if they would move to another country, their AIDS would disappear. They would still be antibody positive, but there's the majority of people that are considered to have AIDS in the United States are perfectly healthy.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can, Elizabeth.
Beth, you I think you disappeared off the call for a while, so why don't you jump in with a question?
Elizabeth, are you there?
I think she's gone again. Well, we're just going to do the best.
Yeah, I'm... PRN is telling me they're not getting me.
We can hear you.
Hold on. Yeah, PRN is telling me I'm not on the call.
Well, you are now.
I am talking, but I hope that our audiences can hear.
Yeah.
It just brought up a point for me that AIDS has been subject to definitions every few years. So, that in itself is kind of an issue where you
I think we lost Elizabeth again. Good old Skype.
Did we lose me again?
Yeah, you're
Hello?
Back now.
We did.
I'm having kind of a problem with this, so people will understand if you just conduct the interview. I try to cut it in every once in a while, but it probably won't be very fruitful. I'll just kind of a thing, David.
Yes. That's really unfortunate, the voice quality we're having with Elizabeth, but we'll continue because her voice is going in and out. One of the other things that this new CDC document does is it really elevates the importance of the viral load test, which, as they point out, is not approved by the FDA for diagnosis of HIV infection, and yet the CDC is basically saying you can use it for the diagnosis of HIV infection.
Yeah,
what's going to happen there?
Because, the antibody tests do not explicitly say do not use this test to diagnose infection with HIV. They just never make a claim that you can use it to diagnose infection with HIV. On the other hand, the nucleic acid test explicitly warned that their test is not intended for use in diagnosing or confirming infection with HIV, and yet this document now is saying that those tests in and of themselves can be used to document infection.
Yes. It says that one of the ways to diagnose HIV infection is with a multi-test algorithm, which is sort of the old way of ELISA plus Western blot, but they've expanded the tests that can be used, which dumbs down the tests considerably. But they're also saying that a positive viral load test by itself can be used to identify HIV infection. And yet, has there ever been a widespread survey of the HIV antibody negative population using a viral load test?
Oh, yes, there has. And, you know, not widespread survey, but sort of a quality control in research publications. And depending on the test, you know, I've seen as high as a 20% false positive rate using certain nucleic acid primers, they're called. I don't want to get technical.
Right.
But I think a generally accepted false positive rate right now is about 1 to 3%.
But I mean, if you test every American, I mean, if they say, okay, well, the HIV viral load test is a real simple way to test HIV infection, so we're going to pull in 300 million Americans every year for an HIV test. I mean, 1% of that, is that
big?
Not 3 million people?
Yeah, that's 3 million people. In other words, you'd have more. I mean, CDC estimates approximately 1 million persons in the United States are HIV positive based on ELISA and Western blot testing and surveillance, et cetera. So you'd have three times that many false positives if you use these to screen the general population.
Yeah, I mean, the implications of this are just horrible. Now, if doctors decide to continue using ELISA plus Western blot, then the rate of false positives will be similar to what we've seen in the past. But if they all say, well, gee, viral load is way more high-tech than old antibody testing, let's go to that, we could see this massive fake epidemic, false epidemic of HIV infection with people based on viral load tests. But this
yes.
definition actually gets worse than that, right? And they have a second category for diagnosing HIV infection, which is based on clinical non-laboratory evidence.
Yes.
And it says clinical criteria for a confirmed case are met by the combination of. So this is a bit it's a bit strange. This is clinical evidence. The first thing that you need, this is mandatory, is a note
right.
in a medical record by a physician or other qualified medical care provider that states that the person has HIV infection. So, am I having a bad dream? Did they really write this?
Well, as I said, I don't know who this document is addressed to, but it is on the level of being absurd. First of all, nobody has access to medical records outside of a criminal or civil investigation where the court orders access to those medical records. So I don't know who's going to be perusing through physicians' medical records. I've been surprised before. And who, what doctor in their right mind would write in a medical record that the person is HIV infected without first testing them?
Well, it actually explicitly says that the second thing you need, apart from the note, is laboratory criteria met based on tests done after the physician's note was written, validating the note retrospectively. So that the physician looks at you and says, gee, you're a gay man, you're a black American, you're an IV drug user, I think you're HIV infected. Let's do some lab tests. And then if one of the lab tests comes back, it's like you're then HIV infected, even if it's not an HIV test.
Yeah, one possible interpretation here is, as you're aware, I do testify in many criminal cases, or
right.
write affidavits in many criminal cases. We have run across many where there is a diagnosis of HIV infection, and yet there are no laboratory records to back that up. That which is very powerful for us in a legal argument is that
right.
you can't do this. You can't just take the notes from a doctor. This would suggest that we would be in trouble if after the fact, somebody drew a sample from that person and they tested positive, then they could say, you're out of luck, legal team, because now we have a confirmed infection. Problem is, if the test is conducted 2-3 years down the road, or in our cases, sometimes 11-12 years down the road, how do you know when that, if you want to believe the test, how do you know when that person became infected? At the date that it was written in his original medical record, or last week?
Well
last month.
Yeah, I was wondering if this new section was added specifically to address some of the legal cases you've been involved with, because the second way to achieve a definition of HIV infection, you still need to note, the second thing is presumptive evidence of HIV infection. So if somebody has a receipt, has received HIV antiretroviral therapy, or prophylaxis treatment for an opportunistic infection, has an unexplained low CD4 immune cell count, or an otherwise unexplained diagnosis of an opportunistic illness. So if you come into the doctor with, say, thrush, and he writes a note saying he thinks you have HIV, then you've met this definition of HIV infection.
Well, yeah, and there's many problems here. One is that this is kind of saying if a person was perceived to be HIV positive, there were no tests to back that up, they were erroneously put on antiviral therapy and prophylaxis for something that they don't have, that now is not a crime. I don't know if it's technically a crime, but it's inhuman, but that confirms their infection.
So in the laundry,
erroneously on therapy, could confirm their infection, and as you said, or an unexplained diagnosis of opportunistic illness. There is an appendix. I don't believe thrush is on there, but esophageal candidiasis, many of the common immunosuppressed opportunistic infections. And even worse, now this document says you no longer have to confirm that opportunistic illness. In the past, you had to run a confirmatory test to be certain that your clinical suspicion of thrush or esophageal candidiasis was real, or PCP, or whatever. Now you don't have to do a confirmatory test on the opportunistic infection.
Or on HIV. I mean, this is saying if a doctor... So I think this is maybe unlikely to actually happen in a doctor's office unless the doctor really wants to give you a bad day. But in the case of a legal case, so, you know, if you had a situation where somebody was suing because they had been diagnosed HIV positive, it turns out that there never was a proper HIV testing sequence done, and they'd been put on antiretroviral drugs, suffered tremendous side effects, possibly liver disease, cancer, something like that, and then they turn around and sue. And then the doctor can say, well, according to the standards of the Centers for Disease Control as published in April 11, 2014, you are HIV infected, so it was appropriate to give you antiretroviral drugs. And the drugs themselves are the proof of HIV infection. So it's totally circular logic.
Right. And that was the case. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine now.
Okay, great. We resolved our tech problems. But that was the case in the Craig Davis trial, which you recently testified in down in Atlanta, Georgia, where I believe it was stated that Mr. Davis had been on antiretroviral treatment, and so therefore he acknowledged that he had an HIV infection, and that was sort of used against him, or we presume that was used against him, and he was declared guilty of trying to infect this woman with HIV. So it seems like it was written in there that if you've taken the treatment, you're guilty. It was written in there just as a reference to this case. I mean, that's just strange.
Well, as you can probably appreciate, I can't comment directly on any of these cases. However, in general terms, this is going to be a problem for a legal defense. And first of all, we should let your audience know that it is not a crime in the U.S. to have HIV. It is a crime in maybe, I think, 34 states to have HIV or perceived to have HIV or to have been told that you have HIV and not disclose it to a sexual partner. That is the crime, and these are very serious crimes, carrying jail time of 10, 15, 20 years in some cases. And it's still he said, she said, or he said in many cases. If you know, it seems like a reasonable defense. Well, you guys can't even produce an antibody test. I mean, I'll argue that those antibody tests are not sufficient to diagnose infection anyway. But if you don't even have an antibody test or any record of an antibody test or any screening test, and you put this person on toxic medications, that is very concerning.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like they're rewriting the law so that they can avoid these cases in the future, or rewriting the rules of testing.
That's speculative, and since, you know, this is my part of my profession, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. We don't want you to, you know, do something that might damage things,
different
but
cases.
It should be noted that you have testified in these cases, and quite ably.
So it is difficult to test. I can see, I mean, what could happen here is that a doctor who has a heavily HIV/AIDS practice could bring in somebody that he, like I said earlier, prejudicially thinks you're probably HIV infected because you're a promiscuous gay man, because you're an IV drug user, because you're black and I think you're promiscuous. I can say, I think you're HIV infected, and then I can, you know, tell you, I think we should get a whole bunch of blood work done here, and then you can look through the blood work, or maybe the patient came in with a minor infection that they wanted treated, and then you can tell the person, you know, on the basis of the CDC algorithm, you are HIV infected, and you must not have sex with anybody unless you tell them that you're HIV infected, which is basically equivalent to never having sex again, because you're unlikely to find somebody willing to have sex with you if they know that you're HIV positive.
Yeah, it's very convoluted. But it could be worse than that, David. It could be a person comes into a physician and they tell them they're infected based on a public health clinic misunderstanding or mix-up.
Right.
Or another doctor somehow got the information that this person is HIV positive. They don't ask
right.
for the evidence. It's if another physician says that this person's HIV positive, even if it's wrong or incorrect or a misunderstanding or a clerical error, whatever, this completely absolves the physicians of erroneously prescribing these toxic medications.
Not coincidentally, when the liability is starting to appear, you know, the court cases are starting to be filed. Yeah, it's scary. And, you know, when you consider the human cost of all this false testing, and also the fact that once you test positive, you can never be declared negative. I mean, it's true in the case of Christine Maggiore, that she had all these negative and indeterminate tests, but the one that was positive was the one that everybody quoted in the media. So, I mean, people should be warned about this product, and also that there is now effectively, perhaps, and we're speculating, no liability. When there's no liability on the other side, you know you're entering a no accountability zone. So,
well,
you know, buyer beware. Don't take the test.
I'd be far more concerned if these recommendations had come from the Food and Drug Administration. As I said, these recommendations can be based on nothing other than so-called expert opinion. And why they would put this convoluted language in here, absurd language, for defining infection is a mystery to me, and I can only speculate as regards to the legal implications.
There seems like there's a distinction being made here between surveillance definition and diagnosis definition, where you're making a distinction between the FDA, which deals with individuals, and the CDC, which deals with public health. I think you've made this point before, that there's a difference between the standards used by people involved in regulating products and the standards of people perhaps with political conflicts of interest who sit on these boards recommending public health measures. That this is a more political decision than a scientific one.
Right. The FDA is a consumer protection agency, and the CDC is dedicated to protecting public health. So in that sense, if you think that three-fourths of your ELISA-positive, Western blot-positive patients are actually false positives or negative, you have to tell all of them that they're positive. Otherwise, they're going to go out and put the rest of the population at risk. So you sacrifice three. If there's one real infection out of four, three people's lives are kind of messed up unnecessarily, but you protected the public from that one real infection. So that's how they're looking at this. And
but,
that's
I mean,
why
that,
they don't
that
have...
protection comes at the cost of those people if they have a low CD4 count, or sometimes these days, not even then, being prescribed antiretroviral medications that cause serious organ failure and many other side effects, like bone weakening that can result in fracturing of the spine, cancers, all kinds of things. So to sacrifice
exactly.
the lives of three people to protect against potentially one person, and we don't even know if it's even one out of four, is really inhumane.
Well, I'm just saying that's the difference between public health concerns and individual health concerns.
But explain this to me, Rodney. It says here, and I think you brought this up earlier, this revised case definition, like the earlier one, is intended primarily for public health surveillance of HIV infection on a population level.
Yep.
So how do you have a doctor sitting at his desk writing a note in the context of a population survey? Like, that doesn't seem
to
jive.
No, you don't. So as I said, I don't know who this document is written to. We have the one small annual survey in the United States where this document could be applicable. But if you want to read it, you know, as for surveillance only, population surveillance. So it's really a mystery to me. You know, another possibility is that hundreds of scientists got together and spent, millions of dollars and many years, and they had to come up with a document that sort of justified all their labors.
All the billings to the CDC.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't actually say, I think, in here who developed, well, the few doctors listed at the top. But it seems like it seems like a definition that's oriented towards individual diagnosis, and I think that this will be used that way. But I guess one factor in court is that it's pretty hard to come into court with a document that says it's purely a surveillance definition and then say, on the basis of a surveillance definition, I diagnose this man or woman as HIV infected.
No, you're absolutely right, David, but it could serve nicely to confuse a jury. After all, you know, the CDC is a very prestigious organization with, the world's best research scientists
yeah.
in the general public's mind. So,
I kind of get the impression that juries don't even need that to be impressed. They're just operating on a purely emotional level in these cases. So this formalizes that kangaroo court aspect.
Yeah,
well,
I mean,
yeah,
I think it would be like taking a black man into court 50 years ago on a charge of raping a white woman. I mean, and you have a white jury. I think that would be a 99% conviction rate without any consideration of the evidence.
Right.
Yeah, that was before mass media could spread, spread the news like wildfire through the community, where it's virtually impossible to get an unbiased jury. And for somebody to have HIV or think they have HIV, whether it's real or not, and have sex with another person thinking it's infectious, you know, that kind of makes them pond scum. It's not, you know, maybe it's not illegal if you can't, but it's certainly an emotional situation for the jury, and I can empathize. It's like, well, even though, the defense put up a good argument, there's no test to prove he's infected, the guy's pond scum.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. It just seems like they're sort of wasting their time and even changing the standard if all they have to do is go before a jury and just make all these wild claims that he was a jerk. But when we're talking about civil cases, we're really talking about money on the table, and we're talking about product liability, a product liability nightmare coming up for these companies putting out the tests and these doctors who are standing behind them. So I think that's where the rubber meets the road, and why they're changing these testing protocols, as they say, algorithms, to make it sound very sophisticated. But I think that's where it's going to make a difference, and or could possibly make a difference. And that's shocking to me, that you can't sue someone or might not be able to sue someone for doing this to you.
How do people protect themselves against this kind of situation? Because you could be going into a doctor's office, the doctor says, let's run a HIV viral load on you, and you know, the average person wouldn't know that that's a terribly dangerous thing to do. So, Rodney, what are your suggestions for how people who are listening could protect themselves from a false positive HIV diagnosis?
That's a difficult question to answer. In fact, I used to do public seminars around the country, and in an effort to try to get this information out to patients and to educate them as to how the tests work, what they're designed for, how they should be used. And, you know, after a while, I started realizing what I was doing was kind of confusing people, because now they said, well, you mean I may not be infected with HIV? And I said, that's correct. Well, should I take these medications anymore? And I said, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to make recommendations for medications one way or the other. Find a doctor that you can trust and trust them. So I really kind of left them not hopeless, but breathless, you know, in a sense.
Right.
Because before, at least they had, you know, this germ's killing me. These medicines are killing the germ. It's a battle. It's making me sick, but I'm alive. And there was some kind of hope, false hope, perhaps, but, you know, there was some kind of hope. So I don't know how to, you know, get this to the public. It's, you know, one of the only places I feel safe speaking truthfully about HIV and the shortcomings of the diagnostic tests is when I'm under oath in an affidavit or in court, where I can tell the truth. So that's kind of where I find myself.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that there are any tests or any combinations of tests that can, with a high degree of certainty, determine if somebody is infected with HIV?
You know, in my affidavit, I list a set of criteria where I think it would be appropriate. You know, as I said before, I'm a chemist, and I don't think the work has been done to prove to purify HIV and to do this right. I'm not a virologist. The community of virologists think the work is done. Okay, fine. Still, I think a person should have to have a risk consistent with infection, symptoms consistent with infection, a positive ELISA, a positive Western blot, and a positive culture before they are told that they're HIV positive.
And on that basis, the vast majority of people recently diagnosed in the United States would probably not have been diagnosed, at least not at that time, maybe some years later, given that the majority of people diagnosed in the United States are diagnosed on the basis of a low CD4 count and an HIV
or completely asymptomatic.
Yes.
Yeah, in regard to the symptoms, do we still have a minute or two here?
Yeah, we have a couple minutes left, yep.
Okay. I just wanted to, I found this on the CDC webpage. It's a hypothetical question. Why, if there's so many people that have herpes infection in the United States, why doesn't the CDC recommend routine testing of all sexually active people for genital herpes? Okay, it's very similar to HIV.
Right.
But they don't recommend it for herpes. Now, the answer that the CDC gives us back here is that these tests can be expensive. False positive test results may occur in some persons with low likelihood of infection, and the diagnosis may have adverse psychological effects for some people.
You can say that in spades for HIV. I mean, the psychological effects are way, way worse. The drugs are worse, I think. Everything's worse about it, and yet they do it routinely.
And they go on here and says, it's not clear that the identification of persons with HSV or herpes infection would decrease the spread of herpes in the population. There is no evidence that detection of HSV infection through testing of persons with no symptoms suggestive of herpes leads to a change in their sexual behavior. And again, they say the tests are expensive and it may hurt people's feelings.
Right. Well, yeah, we have to consider the human wreckage here, and I think that's the real message here, although you're not, you know, you're a scientist, you're not a social scientist. It's just devastating, the terminology that is misleading people and the secretive testing of people without their consent in New York State, which is a whole other podcast. I mean, it's just devastating news, and it's not justified by the lack of certainty of these tests, and certainly not by the new protocol. I mean, unbelievable that they would do this to people, don't you think?
As I said, I use the word absurd.
Yeah.
Absurd. Yeah.
Well, I don't think
the humor is quite clear to the people who've gotten these test results. You know, They're not saying it's absurd. They're saying it's criminal.
Yes, I agree. We've pretty much come to the end of this episode of The Infectious Myth, a joint broadcast with the podcast How Positive Are You? And I'd like to thank Elizabeth for co-hosting with me, and also Dr. Rodney Richards for sharing his expertise on HIV testing. If you want to write to me, you can write at david.crow, and that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. And I hope you will continue to listen to these broadcasts as we bring other important information about science and medicine to you. All I would like to say is if you're considering getting HIV tested or you are offered an HIV test by your physician, that you should ask what kind of test is going to be used or has been used and what were the specific results, not just your HIV positive or negative, but ask some specific questions. And if you don't feel that the answers indicate that your medical professional really knows a lot about HIV testing, then you should really take that into account as well. I mean, if you know more about HIV testing than your doctor, why are you going to trust the results that come out? So thank you both for joining me today, and thanks to the audience for listening. And please spread the word about...
Thank you. Bye-bye.